Well, hi, simply hi, everyone. Move over, Anita Bryant, because here comes the Colonel. Gracious, I love that mustache.
Oh, yeah, right. Where'd that come from? I don't think anybody in our audience remembers Anita Bryant. Oh, well, welcome back. The second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. In just a bit, we're going to get back to our interview with George Markowski. He's professor of computer science engineering at University of Maine and has some fascinating things to tell us about cyber warfare. And we'll also have a brief commentary on the National Geographic March edition cover story, War on Science. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set, rummage around in the coin jar for just a minute, and then for today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Yes, of course. We have awakened the spirit of the fountain because we threw in the coins. The spirit of the mountain, of the fountain who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. All right. Oh, spirit of the fountain, here is today's query. Let's see if we can stump you with this one. I bet we can't. This one's a pretty easy one. The Sholin Mountains, the K-O-L-E-N Mountains, run along the border between Norway and which other country? The Sholin Mountains, oh, spirit of the fountain, run between Norway and which other country?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the other.
Aha! I knew this was an easy one. You didn't need any time to even think about it. All right. The K-O-L-E-N Mountains run along the border between Norway and which other country? If you said Sweden, absolutely, you are absolutely correct. Of course they do. All right, back to our program. Okay, the music of our Science News studio band takes us back to our interview with George Markowski, professor of computer science from the University of Maine.
Yeah, I just want to get back to the point you were talking about, the difference between cyber criminals and state actors.
Okay, good.
You remember not too long ago, I think in January, December, there was this major attack on J.P. Morgan and several other banks, attributed to Russian hackers.
Yeah.
Well, just coincidentally, that attack followed very shortly upon us imposing new sanctions over Russia, on Russia over Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the official Russian line is, well, those hackers, we don't control them. They just decided to attack J.P. Morgan. But another line of thought says, well, you know, we're putting economic pressure on Russia, so, you know, with kind of their blessing, a bunch of Russian hackers are attacking our bank.
Yeah.
Okay, now, are those Russian hackers in uniform, or are they totally independent? But I wouldn't be surprised if there's not a link between the Russian government attacking our banks and we putting pressure, economic pressure on Russia, economic sanctions because of Ukraine. So that's why I say I don't think it's a good idea to draw a line between cybercrime and cyber warfare and cyber terrorism, because they all kind of they come out of the same sort of area of expertise, and people can cross the line. And in a state like Russia, I also suspect that large groups of hackers probably are not unknown to the Russian government. So there's the fact that they're not shut down and then are allowed to carry out various kinds of crimes against Western institutions. Do you want to view that as kind of an extension of Russian policy, or is it totally independent? I personally don't think these things are completely independent.
All right. Okay, George. Interesting insight there, but that certainly leads me to another question. I mean, the Stuxnet worm hit Iran a number of years ago, and there weren't too many players out there with the expertise or the motive to do it. I guess we're one of them, or Israel might be another one. What's your take on that? Where did Stuxnet come from?
Oh, I think by now it's been pretty much acknowledged that that was done, you know, by a combination of U.S. and Israeli talent. And what's interesting about Stuxnet was the task that the people were faced with was infiltrating these Iranian centrifuges, which are not on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I know it's the targets were not connected to the internet. So what they did is they created this very elaborate virus worm that would propagate through flash drives. And what it would do is you'd put a flash drive in somewhere, and it would kind of copy itself to that machine and would decide whether this was a centrifuge or not, and then we'd kind of hide in a certain way. And then when another flash drive got put in, it would transfer itself to that flash drive and stay in the machine. And that way it just kind of spread all over the world. The idea being that eventually some person, some Iranian technician or scientist or administrator would take a flash drive to the facility where these centrifuges were and plug it in, and then it would jump to them. Now, not only did this thing kind of propagate itself in looking for these centrifuges, but it only looked for particular kinds of centrifuges made by a certain manufacturer, a certain model number, which we knew the Iranians had. So if you had a different centrifuge or you had, you know, a different model number, Stuxnet would not affect you. But if you had that particular model number by that, or that range of model numbers by that manufacturer, Stuxnet would speed that up. It would kind of lie to you. So it would tell you that the centrifuges are spinning at a certain speed, but it would actually make them been significantly faster, mm-hmm. so that they would be damaged.
Yeah, well, that's as I understand it. I didn't know though that it did, because the United States has never admitted anything, neither has Israel. So I suppose it's the opinion in the scientific community that that we did it and in a league with Israel. But there's been no real evidence to the fact that we did. And you're talking about these flash drives or thumb drives. This all get put on the Siemens equipment before it left Germany, or it happened in concert with a bunch of different flash drives that talked to each other, and the thing didn't work without all that kind of communication. Is that how you see it?
The flash drives didn't talk to each other. You know, once the program, once Stuxnet infected something, it would stay there. Mm-hmm. And then when you put a flash drive into an infected machine, it would transfer a copy of itself to the flash drive. And then when you put the flash drive into some other computer, it would transfer itself to that computer and look around for centrifuges and just kind of kept propagating, and it would just sort of live there, you know, indefinitely until eventually somebody took some flash drive and plugged it into some computer connected to these centrifuges, and then it would do its job.
So was the original infection happened with the Siemens equipment in Germany first before it went to Iran?
I don't think so. I think it happened in Iran.
Okay. All right. Fascinating stuff. All right, George, what do you want your audience to take away from your presentation? I mean, you're going to leave them with a one big thought, or are you just going to demonstrate to them how important it is to have secure passwords?
Well, no. What we do is we first talk about, well, probably there are three parts to this tutorial, and one part sort of does an overview of the kind of political scene and addresses this whole issue of cyber criminals, cyber terrorists, cyber warfare, you know, state-sponsored activities, and kind of overviews that whole scene. Who are the actors? What are the threats? You know, what are some of the kind of cases that have happened? And I think an important point that people have to understand that cyber criminal activity can fund political activity. In other words, if I'm some kind of terrorist group and I want to find, get some money to fund my effort or to buy weapons, I can turn to cybercrime. There's nothing that says I can't be a cyber criminal and then use that money for political activity. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's happening on a regular basis. The other part of it is a lot of these groups are using media and to recruit followers. So, again, sometimes they'll hire people who have all kinds of skills. I mean, they're cyber criminals, but they're happy to work for any group that'll pay them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a clean cut division anyway. So we survey that, we talk about that. Then I introduce them to some tools, and in particular, we focus on a new distribution called Kali Linux, and we talk about it because this is an easy way for people. You download it for free, and it has over 300 tools, mm-hmm. 300 hacking tools on there. Many of these tools have GUI, easy-to-use interfaces, and one of the things I show them is that they can be hackers, too. That if they want to download this toolkit, which is very widely used, that they can actually start. I mean, they can launch an attack an hour after they get, an hour. I mean, they can launch it while they're listening to the lecture. So some of it is showing people how simple it is to get into this realm, at least if you're not ashamed or not afraid of breaking laws and things like that. You can get into this arena. And part of that is to convince people that they have to take security a lot easier. I mean, people can get into this arena for many reasons. You can have ex-lovers who want to get revenge at someone. You can get, husbands and wives who are fighting over custody of the kids. I mean, they can use these tools for their own purposes. I mean, you can have just a simple cyber crime. You can have more complex cyber crime that's tied to political activities, or it can just come in a whole lot of flavors. And one of the things I think that I try to dispel is that you have to be some kind of a genius to enter this realm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, certainly the best minds in this arena are incredibly gifted people who come up with all sorts of new and novel attacks. But there's a huge amount of effort that's gone to making these tools sort of very easy to use, so that people, even with no real serious computer skills, can use some of these tools and learn how to use them. So that's a second key feature of the tutorial, and we look at some of these tools and discuss how you can do scans. And in fact, one of the things I encourage people to do is to take these tools, take them home on their own network and explore their own network.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, many of our networks are being probed by outsiders. Well, you can at least use the same tools and probe your own network and see what they're seeing.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are all kinds of tools we talk about that, you can put in an address and it'll display all kinds of vulnerable printers. Well, maybe you should look up and see if your printer's on that list. Whether, some person sitting, across the ocean can come in and put malware on your printer, so that any of your devices that link to that printer can get infected.
George, this is going to be a fascinating session. I can imagine it'd be like back in the 1930s, going to a safe cracking conference, being able to know how to protect yourself from the safe crackers because you actually learn how to do those sorts of things. So we're really looking forward to it. It's going to be really great. George Markowski, the professor of computer science at the University of Maine, is going to be giving this tutorial at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference going on the middle of April, April 14th to the 16th in Boston, Massachusetts. And if you want more information on that, go to our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link, and you can hit on that, and you will learn all that you need to know about the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference. George, would you kind of put the thinking cap on for just a minute, look down the road maybe 5 years, 10 years or so into the future? Give us a glimpse of where things are going. What can we see 5, 10, 20 years down the road?
Well, I think that there will be changes, you know, to the way we do business. I suspect that there will be more maybe biometric kinds of systems instead of passwords, because it's hard to get people to cooperate. But it may be easier if we wear some kind of device on our belts or carry it in our wallets or something that identifies us, or use the kinds of things you've seen in already there are a bunch of phones and things that have fingerprint scanners where you have to, you know, put your finger on a device. And they don't always operate 100% accurately, and so people get frustrated. But I think that over time, a lot of these biometric devices will become better, and they'll work, you know, with a much higher degree of probability. So it may be that in the not too distant future, you'll see less reliance on passwords than we have now. I also think that we are getting a lot more concerned about writing software that's harder to break. Okay, one of the problems is that we need to change the curriculum that we have for computer science graduates so that they become more aware of the kinds of weaknesses that have been routinely put into software, so that they can write better software that's harder to infect and harder to crack. And then I'm hoping that, you know, through things like this tutorial, where people realize how easy it is for someone to get these tools and create mischief, that people say, you know, I really do need to think a little bit about security. I do need to take seriously that if we have sensitive records of people, like say I'm a teacher, I'm a banker, I have an insurance company or something, I have to worry about how to protect sensitive data of my customers. Okay, that's not a 2-minute kind of discussion, but I think that to the extent that we can get people thinking about it, realizing how serious the stakes are, then we can build a more secure system. And of course, continue to improve the technology. You know, lots of technical things that are being done that will make things more secure, built on top of existing technology. So it's not, I don't think at this point it's a matter of like scrapping everything and starting from scratch, because anytime you build new systems, there are always bugs and weaknesses. I think what it is taking what we have, coming up with a more consistent posture, taking security more seriously at every stage, at the stage when we design software, at the stage where we build software, where we deploy software. We need to improve awareness, security awareness of people. I mean, in the same way that, you know, when people go walking at night in some deserted part of the city, I mean, you can give them some safety tips, like number one, don't do it. Number two, if you must do it, you know, stay in lighted areas, follow these protocols, you know, have your cell phone ready to dial 911. I mean, things like that. And I think we need to develop rules for the average consumer to help protect that person. I guess security is important, and you have to take it seriously. I mean, that would be my bottom line. You know? And it's just, and the other thing I guess that we routinely tell people is security is a process. Okay, and the instant you think that you've mastered it and you're completely invulnerable, that's the point at which you have a problem. Like, if you think you're invulnerable, you have a problem.
All right. That's a bit of really important information. Don't get complacent. That's a really good, good reminder. Thanks so much, George. George Markowski, professor of computer science at the University of Maine, is going to be giving a lecture at the Homeland Security Technology Symposium, where IEEE is hosting the 14th through the 16th, the middle of April, and we'll look forward to seeing you there, George. Thanks so much for giving us a taste of what we can expect at the conference.
Well, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk about this vitally important area of security, and I hope that maybe I inspired some people to start thinking about it more seriously.
And finally, George, for those who want to think about it more seriously, we ought to remind them about your website. I don't think we touched on that, so let's do it here. Cybermaine.org. Cybermaine. Maine, M-A-I-N-E, as in the state of Maine. So to really stay abreast of the latest in security, yeah, go to cybermaine.org. Okay, in just a few minutes coming up is the Voice of Reason, but I want to point out for a moment the cover story of the March issue of National Geographic magazine. The War on Science is what it's titled. Climate change does not exist. Evolution never happened. The moon landing was fake. Vaccinations can lead to autism. And genetically modified food is evil. Those are some of the, examples that National Geographic gives. For in their cover story, as an example of the war on science, and it goes on to say in the article that we live in an age when all matter of scientific knowledge, from the safety of fluoride and vaccines to the reality of climate change, faces organized and often furious opposition. Empowered by their own sources of information and their own interpretation of research, doubters have declared war on the consensus of experts. Yes, it's an interesting article. You may want to pick it up. It goes on to say there's so many of these controversies these days, you'd think a diabolical agency had put something in the water to make people argumentative. And there's so much talk about the trend these days in books, articles, and academic conferences that science doubt itself has become a pop culture. We're asked to accept, for example, that it's safe to eat food containing genetically modified organisms because the experts point out there's no evidence that it isn't and no reason to believe that altering genes precisely in a lab is any more dangerous than altering them wholesale through the traditional breeding. And the article points out that modern biology makes no sense without the concept of evolution. But religious activists in the United States continue to demand that creationism be taught as an alternative in biology class. When science conflicts with a person's core beliefs, it usually loses, the article says. So you might want to pick up the March issue of National Geographic. It's a fascinating, fascinating read. And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to the this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the Voice of Reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
You know, with regards to cyber warfare is, you know, I would say stay current with, you know, what's happening out there. I think if you're a corporation, even if you're a small company, you should realize that your intellectual property is likely your most valuable resource, and you should take every effort to try to protect that. And I think as citizens of the United States, we should accept the fact that investments in cyber warfare is something that we should embrace as a priority for our government, because so much of our lives is dependent on computer systems, and I think as citizens, we should appreciate this and accept that this has to be elevated as a priority. Paulo Shakarian, I'm a major in the U.S. Army and an assistant professor in the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point.
So you decide, has this really been the Voice of Reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you. I